YW.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that the 8 millisecond normally of television refresh rate is 16 milliseconds, so it's just twice as fast.
Do you believe that the liquid crystals can blank out enough in that period of time? Or I think you're saying that's part of the mechanism of a little bit of bleed of left and to right.
No, it's a little bit the glasses themselves, a little bit the crystals, the liquid crystal cells themselves. I mean, you'll see the 3D sets at 240 hertz refresh rate. But, you know, given the content, I mean, you set it upright, it looks perfect, but, you know, depending upon contrast and stuff like that, sometimes there's a little bit of bleed.
The actual liquid crystals on the television display, what's the approximate time constant of them to go from state A to state B? Eric, go ahead.
No, the 240 hertz set refresh rate is around a little less than 2 milliseconds for a refresh, because you're doing it on a line-by-line basis. But really, I mean, one line is 64 microseconds worth of information, so you can actually flip a single cell, I think, is something like, I don't remember that. I can look that up, but I think it's something like 25 microseconds or something in that order.
I'm amazed it's that fast, because you're physically moving little particles that are in that liquid crystal material, and they can move that fast. How about that?
Yeah, that's a long way from your little calculator.
It sure is. In the case of heating water in a microwave oven, you're asking those water molecules to flip back and forth twice 2.45 giga flips per second. And obviously they do it with a lag. And after you've heated water with a microwave oven, and the water is hotter, by definition, the water molecules are moving faster. They got more kinetic energy. What did they push against in order to get moving faster? Over to you, Eric.
What was that last question?
When I heat up a cup of water in a microwave oven, the water goes from tap temperature to boiling temperature. It gets a lot hotter. Higher temperature. Higher temperature means each and every molecule has more kinetic energy. That means they are physically moving faster. They got more speed. So the microwave oven speeds up the water molecules. What did they push against in order to get higher speed? Over to you, Eric.
Well, they also move farther apart from each other now, don't they? What do they push against? Why don't you answer that?
They don't move further apart. You heat up water, there is almost no change in the density. I'm not talking about when you boil it. And if you think the heating is the effect, well, I could be heating water at 0 degrees centigrade and heat it up to 4 degrees centigrade, and it contracts while I'm heating it. So that doesn't explain it. Over to you, Eric.
Well, we know that the molecules are rotating, okay, and what we're doing is we're pumping energy into it. And what you're really asking is, what's causing the molecules to rotate?
Now, that one I accept. The two hydrogens of a water molecule are separated from each other by 104.42 degrees or something like that. And that's just the way the physics lies. And as such, the hydrogen end of the water molecule is positively charged. The negative end of the water molecule is the oxygen end. The oxygen end is negative. So the water molecule is a dipole molecule. And therefore, it tries to follow the E field on each half cycle. And it does it with a slight phase lag. That hysteresis loop is the energy absorption. So they're flipping back and forth at the same time that they're bouncing into each other. So I think the flipping and the bouncing represents a kind of bat and ball effect, and as such, they bounce away from each other at a faster velocity than they approached. That's my best guess as to what's going on. Can't find any article that says that. Over to you, Eric.
Ah, okay, I see where you're going. And actually, you can find, but you have to just look for the right stuff. MRIs, the whole concept of MRI and how it operates is based upon a hydrogen atom and its resonant frequency and what happens with it.
There's a couple of good books on that, and I think there's some, you can Google that out. I've run across that a couple times, and they get into the whole concept of how the water molecule is formed and how it's weighted and how it moves. And really, how the changing, what is it, the changing level of energy when you excite the hydrogen molecule with not only RF, but not only magnetism, but RF. And there's a resonant frequency, I think it's around 65 megahertz. I don't remember what it is. It's been a long time since I've read about it, but there's a lot of info there.
I thought the first molecular resonance of water is somewhere around 21 gigahertz. I know that the RF portion of an MRI runs at a much, much lower frequency. On top of that, one explanation I've read is that you've got a very strong magnetic field in, let's say, the Z direction, but you're doing a small amount of modulation of that magnetic field in the X or the Y direction in order to do the imaging. I'm not quite sure what's going on there. Over to you, Eric.
You know, if I get a chance, I'll see if I can find the information, and we can talk about it next week.
Okay. And if you really want to get into something difficult to explain, explain combustion at the molecular level. Hydrogen and oxygen molecules, I've got them mixed together as gas. I pass a spark through it, which means I'm speeding up some of those molecules, and all of a sudden, one of the hydrogens decides to join an oxygen molecule. And that's a highly exothermic reaction. It's giving off a lot of energy. Does that mean it's giving off a photon? And now that new molecule is moving at a much higher velocity. What the hell did it push against to do that? So how do you propagate the chain reaction that you and I call combustion at the molecular level? And you've been studying combustion. You might have an answer for that one, Eric.
Actually, there's a lot of theories, but there's one thing that most people don't realize. If something is going to burn, it's got to have hydrogen. And if it's going to burn, it has to have oxygen. But the fuel part, it's always the hydrogen. It comes in different forms, in terms of hydrocarbon or even the simplest alcohol. Anything that burns with oxygen must have hydrogen or it doesn't burn.
Okay, so I've got some water. I pour current through it because I'm doing electrolysis. I'm pouring energy into the system. I'm breaking the bond. I'm pulling the hydrogen molecules, hydrogen atoms, away from the oxygen atoms. And I bubble out hydrogen and oxygen in the process. I've poured energy into it to do that, the electrolysis. I've now got hydrogen molecules and oxygen molecules, hydrogen and oxygen atoms, at a higher potential energy because I've separated them. Somehow, when I do the combustion of hydrogen and oxygen, the potential energy gets converted into kinetic thermal energy. And what really goes on there? I'm starting to guess that the hydrogen atom approaches the oxygen atom at a glancing angle. They don't exactly hit center to center. Therefore, there's conservation of rotational energy, conservation of momentum, and therefore they end up with a huge spin after they come together. And that spinning molecule, the next time it encounters another molecule, is going to do this bouncing action, the bat and ball action, and they fly apart at a much higher velocity. That's a guess. Over to you, Eric.
No, that's not a bad guess. Also, the thing that we don't realize is that when you do the recombining of the hydrogen and oxygen, if you actually were to measure the molar weight of the materials that you start with, the amount of energy that you put into it, again, hydrogen is a carrier of energy. It's not a fuel source. It always takes some external force to separate it. And when you put it back together and you take that molar weight, you're missing something. You always lose something. And what is that something you lose?
So I'm guessing now that, this is E equals MC squared type stuff. The energy you lose is accounted by the change in the mass. When hydrogen combines with oxygen during combustion, do you believe a photon is given off in that process?
Well, yeah, actually, if you want to avoid going into quantum mechanics, yes, because with most combustion,
you get light in some form, and it doesn't have to be visible. It can be infrared. It can be in the form of heat.
Okay. When that photon is given off, does that give you a recoil that now makes that water molecule move fast enough to collide with the next hydrogen or oxygen molecule and continue the chain reaction that you and I call combustion? Where does all that extra velocity come from? Over to you, Eric.
Okay, now we're talking physics in terms of where is that excitation energy? All right, let's talk about a light-emitting diode. Where does that energy come from?
I had the impression that within the light-emitting diode material, there's an extremely strong electrostatic attraction between two of the layers of that material. And somehow the forward biasing of that diode creates some kind of a tunnel reaction that results in a photon being given off. But as you can tell, I'm pretty vague on this one. Over to you, Eric.
All right, well, here's the magic thing. Where in the energy band of a particular atom or in an electron itself, when you tunnel that, how do we make that transference from a physical particle with an energy potential to a non-physical particle that is neither particle nor wave? I don't know if you're aware of this, but when you separate hydrogen and oxygen, it does naturally want to recombine without the process of combustion. If you actually allow the two gases to sit with each other, you'll eventually get all that water back. It takes a long time, but it'll happen.
Yeah, ordinarily, air molecules are bouncing off each other with a perfect bounce because there's a strong electrostatic cloud of electrons on the outside of every one of those atoms. So they bounce very efficiently against the walls, against each other, or whatever. And on average, air molecules are 3 nanometers apart, and they move around with 500 meters per second of average speed, and the mean free path is roughly 63 nanometers, even though their diameter is something like an angstrom, which is what, 0.1 nanometer. So they're very small in diameter. Relativistically speaking, they got large spaces between them, and they're 63 nanometers before they have a mean free path encounter. That's air molecules. And so if I had a vial filled up with 2 parts hydrogen and 1 part oxygen, as far as mole weight is concerned, I'd like to believe those hydrogen-oxygen molecules bounce against each other, again, with high efficiency. And what makes them combine? Who's supplying that minimum energy that makes one of them have enough velocity to really create that bond, as opposed to being electrostatically repulsed and bouncing away from each other? Over to you, Eric.
All right, first of all, in this case, we're talking about ionic bonding as opposed to covalent bonding. You agree?
I think so, but maybe you're going to say that the cosmic rays every so often hit some of those molecules and give them enough velocity to do a little bit of combining. And how come that doesn't initiate a chain reaction? Over to you, Eric.
A hydrogen atom contains one proton and how many electrons?
Just one.
And doesn't it take two to make that orbit complete?
Okay, so there's an intermediate step. At first, I'm going to get an oxygen-hydrogen combination of just one hydrogen, and eventually there's got to be another hydrogen that comes along. Go ahead.
Except that hydroxyls don't exist in nature on their own. I mean, we can create hydroxyls. We can add something with the opposite charge, like we could use sodium, which is positive, which is a metal, sodium hydroxide. So you can have a single eight, an oxygen, and a sodium atom. Now, the oxygen atom, it doesn't have a complete orbit either, does it? Complete outer ring.
I'm slowly beginning to think that if I can't make a hydroxyl in free space as a gas, that I don't get a water molecule, and two, there are two hydrogens willing to simultaneously join with that oxygen. I think you're saying that the first step of an H and an O doesn't happen. It's got to be two H's and an O in the first step. Is that what you're saying?
actually, the if I remember my chemistry right, the outer ring of an oxygen atom has got room for two shared electrons.
Agreed. You could say it's got two empty spaces in its outer ring. Wouldn't it be partially satisfied with one more electron from one more hydrogen as an intermediate step? Wouldn't that be a little bit more stable? And a little bit later, a second hydrogen comes along to complete the process? Over to you, Eric.
Got a question, Dick.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Is it true, I remember from physics, that every particle of water is like any other particle of water, which means that every particle of hydrogen is like every other particle of hydrogen. Is that correct, what I remember, Dick? Over.
If you're talking about pure hydrogen atoms and oxygen atoms, I think the answer is yes. But you got to be careful now. What you and I simplistically call a water molecule, H2O, is not one molecule. It's a dipole molecule, and something like seven of them stick together as a chain. I think that's approximately what's going on with what we call a water molecule. Over to you, Eric.
Actually, you're right, and there is a structure that goes with it. But if we're just going to talk about ionic bonding, okay, in order for things in nature like to be balanced, right? Things don't like to be out of balance. We don't like having things that have a charge in one direction and a charge in the other direction stand on their own. For example, a single atom of hydrogen doesn't exist. It always comes in pairs. Yes, you can have a single atom of oxygen, but put it in the proximity of something that will share its electron, they go grab each other.
So, isn't most hydrogen H2? Isn't most oxygen O2? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, when you're talking about single units, because they can't exist as single units now, can they?
Okay, what makes two oxygens, if each oxygen has two extra spaces in its outer ring? Bringing two of them together doesn't really complete those rings. Why are they happy to be only two of them together, Eric? Go ahead.
We call it two of them together, but it's not two. It's actually bunches of them together. There's another force that we're talking about here. Let me see if I can pull it out of my head. Because you're still, when you have two of them together, right, what it is that they're sharing their spaces. I can give you a better explanation for this, but it's not being clear right now. Because the outer rings of electrons will actually share electrons to make it feel as though it's complete, so to speak.
Okay, simplistically, I think an oxygen is the eighth element of the periodic table. The first ring is stable with two electrons. The next ring wants eight, but it only has six. So it's got two empty spaces. And so I think you're saying some number of these oxygen molecules, we call it O2, but some number of these oxygen atoms clump together, and somehow they're happier, and they think their outer ring is being shared and almost stable until some hydrogens come along. Over to you.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to explain it.
But those hydrogens that come along have to come along with a specific amount of energy before anything happens. I can have a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen in that flask, and it appears to be pretty happy until I put a spark in there, and then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, well, now you're adding another source of external energy to the equation.
Okay, so that external source of energy is speeding up the living daylights out of either some hydrogens or some oxygens. With that extra velocity, they ram together and stick. But that first molecule that rammed together and sticked, it has to leave that reaction with a tremendous amount of velocity in order to hit the next couple of them alongside in order to carry on the chain reaction. I'm still having a little trouble finding out where all that extra velocity is coming from. What are they pushing against in order to sustain the chain reaction?
Something to do with the second law of thermodynamics.
Yeah. P V equals NRT and all of these formulas tell you how much, but they don't tell you how or why at the molecular level. All of a sudden, for some strange reason, I'd like to be able to understand what's happening at the molecular level. Over to you, Eric.
All right, if I remember, there is a equation for what I think, what do they call it? There is, there's a specific heat capacity of every atom, and there's also, what, oh, it's the heat of fusion, that's what it is. There's a particular point in terms of energy that allows it to share its potential energy of the electron ring, meaning that if you take two mono atoms of something and put them together, there's a specific amount of kinetic energy required for them to stick their outer orbits together and share those electrons, so to speak.
When water is in the gaseous form as a water vapor, I'd like to know, in water vapor under standard temperature and pressure, are those individual water molecules, or again, are they clumped together? I think they can't be clumped together, because clumped together, that's liquid form. Are they individual water molecules when they're in the gaseous form? But then the word gaseous form has also got all kinds of variables to it. I can have hydrometeors, I can have water vapor with very small little droplets of water or very large droplets of water. Hail, rain, mist, fog. Boy, there's a lot of variables going on here. Over to you, Eric.
All right, well, let's take a little twist. I mean, if we're going to talk about oxygen, I mean, there's allotropes of oxygen. I mean, take ozone, for example. So, you know, what's ozone? Is that dioxygen? Okay, and there's other forms. Now my brain is beginning to with this stuff. So trioxygen, right? And all of these things exist in the upper atmosphere.
As I run my Wim Hof machine and make a whole lot of sparking, I can smell a lot of ozone. So the energy introduced by that sparking of my Wim Hof machine takes O2 and makes O3 out of it. I am curious as to O3, is that a more stable molecule? Does O3 stay as O3 until ultraviolet light or whatever breaks it up? Because once I formed ozone, if I put it in a jar and I come back a day later, is it still ozone? Over to you, Eric.
You know that ozone absorbs ultraviolet radiation. I mean, it's that ozone layer that prevents us from getting skin cancer, at least what's left of it. But it does actually break back down into a single molecule of oxygen at one point, and that extra molecule of oxygen finds another extra molecule of oxygen to become, you know, diatomic oxygen.
So in the presence of ultraviolet, for instance, are you saying O3 becomes 3O, which eventually becomes O2? Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, I got to go back and rethink this stuff, because there is a lot of physical state change. Because when you add energy to it, it changes its state. Not once, but twice from what I'm remembering. But, you know, I really need to go open the book and look and then resynthesize my thinking here.
I wonder if it's possible that O3 in the ozone layer, in the presence of ultraviolet radiation, breaks down into O2 plus an O, and then that O joins some other O to become O2 again. But the new O2s have a higher potential energy state. And maybe that explains where the energy of the ultraviolet ray went when it did the conversion of O3 into an O2 plus an O. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Eric.
No, I think the conservation of energy has to be applied here somewhere. You know, I mean, we just don't lose it. There's a reaction. There's got to be a measurable reaction, so to speak, with a slight little bit of loss being, you know, being the universe being the way it is.
Okay, so we know that the O3, the ozone, absorbs ultraviolet. In the process, the mechanism of the absorption is to convert O3 into an O2 plus an O. That's a guess. That the combination of O3 converted to an O2 plus an O has a higher potential energy. The increase is approximately the energy that was absorbed from the ultraviolet ray. And so maybe ozone is being broken down by the process of ultraviolet absorption. And in order to carry on that process, you'd like to continuously be making ozone. Or is it the other way around? Does the ultra...
I'm going to say, maybe we're thinking backwards. Maybe the UV is breaking O2 into single O's, and the O's are mixing with O2s to make O3s.
Yeah, that's what I was about to guess next. So in other words, the ultraviolet rays are creating the O3, is what you're saying. And so the O3 is a higher potential energy state, and that represents the energy of the ultraviolet ray that got absorbed. Over to you, Eric.
I'll agree with that.
So therefore, can I take a jar of O2, pass ultraviolet rays through it, and generate O3? That one I haven't heard of.
Well, could that be what happens in the atmosphere every day?
If it happens in the atmosphere, can I do it in my laboratory?
Well, you do it in your laboratory with electricity, or at least static electricity, don't you?
Okay, so maybe you're saying the spark from my machine is generating an ultraviolet ray, and that ultraviolet ray is what's making the ozone. Maybe that's it.
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but you know what? It's interesting enough to find out.
Yeah, we got to do a lot more research. And this is not an easy one to research. I've tried various words as search engines with Google to try to understand any of these processes at the molecular level. Boy, there ain't much written from that point of view, Eric.
You know, I bet we can probably find more interesting thought if we look into things that nature does, like photosynthesis.
Okay, maybe it's there. Because you're saying the real process of photosynthesis really is happening at the molecular level.
No, yeah, all we're doing is we're taking light, we're taking carbon dioxide, we're taking sugars, and basically what we're doing is we're making oxygen and energy.
Well, I thought the plan by way of photosynthesis is really generating oxygen plus a carbohydrate.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's carbon dioxide and photons, and what am I missing? It's just going to make a it needs water. Now, let me think about that. So that'd be CO2, that would be H2O. I got to get a C6H12 kind of thing. Yeah. It would be carbon dioxide and water. And it would be simple water plus photons that will make you sugar and oxygen.
But for the plant to be happy to really do its thing, the roots are more than sucking up just water. Don't they really need mineral matter from the soil in order to act as at least a catalyst for that process?
All right, if memory serves me correctly, then we're talking about the ATP cycle. ATP cycle with other proteins. I'm just talking about the, not what supports the reaction, but just the reaction itself. Any living thing requires a certain amount of proteins, et cetera, so on, minerals, et cetera, so on and so forth, to support the life, to support the cell material, to support the mitochondria, to support the cell wall, to support all the things that make the seven basic things of life work. We're just talking about one simple translation here that all that other stuff is supported by.
If I I was using a plant in a hydroponic laboratory where I got the roots sitting into pure water, and I got sunlight on those green leaves of that plant, can that plant sustain the life process in that particular laboratory if I don't pour in any other mineral matter?
My first reaction would be no, but it could actually exist, but there might be other bacteria and other things that you have no control over that is part of the process. But, you know, I believe, like, on Mount Haleakala in Hawaii, the air plants, those are plants that have actually they're silvery plants. They have their own form of photosynthesis. They're not based on chlorophyll. There's no nutrients in the soil because the soil is basically volcanic rock. And they get their food, so to speak, from bacteria in the roots.
If you and I were running a farm, we'd have strong motivation to pour nitrate-like fertilizer into that soil. What's nitrate contributing to this process?
Now, nitrogen, okay, in order to create proteins and to create RNA and to create various ribonucleic acids, you need nitrogen in order to create them.
So, pure carbohydrate ain't enough is what you're saying for a stable diet, and I sort of accept that.
Yeah, let's put it this way. In human beings, pure carbohydrates leads to being very overweight.
Yeah, there were people in Ireland who used to live on potatoes as the main staple of their diet. I'm not sure that that's enough.
Oh, well. I think I've had enough for this evening because I have to go to work in the morning. I don't know about you.
Yeah, me and Mel, we've all got to go to work. Hey, Mel, did you stay awake for all of this? K2KEY?
If you want to really understand what's going on, Dick, if you look at the work of thermodynamics, the first and second law worked at Max Planck. I think you may know the name, Max Planck, P-L-A-N-C-K, a scientist, 19th century. He explained the whole thing, how oxygen, hydrogen, it all come together, conservation of energy and the conduction taking place between two bodies of different temperatures and so on and so forth. So I remember that quite well. Max Planck really went into depth on all that, Dick, over.
But I think he left some things to the, that still aren't to this day really explained. It's still theories.
When you're transmitting to us, Eric, I'm hearing some air running in the background. Are you near a transmitter at this time?
You're hearing a fan.
Okay. I thought I was hearing a transmitter. Okay, we got to look up Max Planck. The Planckian equations and so on. And like you said, Eric, I got to go to work in the morning. Mel's got to go to work. We better all say 73. Someday we're going to solve all these problems. You got to Mel, K2RE, to be clear about listening.
I remember quite well this K2KEY, his formulas for H2 plus half O2 something minus H2O again, and then it's equal to what, something like 68,000 calories, I don't remember at this point, but I remember those formulas. Max Planck did a lot of that with all that oxygen combining and all that stuff, so take a look at Max Planck if you get a chance. He went to quite a dissertation on the first and second laws and the conservation of energy as applied to the second law and of thermodynamics. I think you'll find all the answers there. Okay, good night. Yeah, get on. By the time we sign off here, it'll be time to get up, Dick. Good night. Take care. And congratulations again. Great work.
Thank you. Bye-bye, you all.
All right, Dick. Congratulations on your nice award. K2RWK2K.
Good night, Dick. Again, Bravo Zulu on that award. Great.
And Bravo Zulu used to be Baker Zanzibar, I think it was. No, Baker Zebra.
Yeah, I believe it was like three or four different ones. Well, if you look at the list of those, it's endless. Depends on what country you come from. Good night, Dick.
K2EJ, WD2HWW.
Yeah, Howie.
I'm sorry if you heard the link come up, but the only talking you bring it up, it's all the way around it.
Yeah, well, you got a 20-year-old controller, what can I tell you? What can I do for you?
Hello. Still works. What's wrong with a 20-year controller?
It's an ACC, isn't it?
Still the best controller out there. I don't think anybody makes a better controller out there yet. May have better features, but still quality-wise. They broke the mold when they made these things.
Well, the damn thing's made out of the 6502, and it's got a piece of software that's solid, that's all. But it doesn't do much.
It's an 8085, it's not a 6502. Sorry, it's an 8080. It's an Intel processor.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right. It's an 8085, right?
Yeah, it does a lot. I mean, there's a lot more stuff out there. There's asterisks out there. There's all kinds of stuff, but believe me. So what's up, Eric? I actually wanted to ask Dick a question, but I wasn't paying attention. You guys just left. So what's happening? How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I don't mean to cut it short, but I cut it short before so I can get out of here. I got something to take care of before I go to sleep. And if I talk, I'm not going to be able to do that.
I better shut down my link and get out of here. No, I was listening for an hour, and then I wanted to say something, so. You had an ID itself before I came up. All right. How does my audio sound?
Sounds like you. What can I tell you?
Okay. Hope everything is okay with you. I'm going to let you go. WB2HWW.
All right, Howie. 7-3. Have a good night. WB2HWWK2J.
Hey, where's my news line? KTYO.
Patience, it's coming.
Maybe you didn't love me anymore.
How you doing?
Well, pretty good. Just got done with a busy weekend. My niece was in town, so a lot of trips in and out of the city.
That's good. K2YO, K2J.
Oh, have a good evening. I will catch you later. Sitting here working away. K2YO will be clear.
All right, Bernie. I've been in XML land lately. I'm finally getting to get it right. I've been writing some new style sheets that actually work. I'm surprised.
Very cool. What are you writing it in?
XML, or actually XSL. It's XSLT. You can think of it as HTML just for data.
Right, but what language is creating the XML? Are you just using a crayon and a paper towel?
No, it's a tag-oriented language. XML, the tags are not predefined like they are in HTML.
Yeah, that whole XML stuff is can be black magic if the user tries to get a little too convoluted with it. On the surface, it's very straightforward, and it's actually a great idea, but it, like C, is something you can easily shoot yourself with.
Well, again, nothing's defined. You define it as you go, and the style sheets help you turn it into something that's useful. Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, the Plainview system is now back up and running.
What was wrong with it?
Oh, Lightning tried the DSL modem.
Unfortunately, I've got a feeling that's going to be a continual problem for us. It's funny, the cable company hangs wires all over the place and somehow survives Lightning, but putting those big antennas up in the air just seems to attract a lot more.
No, we did Richie dealt with the Verizon, and for 99 cents more a month, we can blow up as many of them as we want, and they'll keep replacing them.
Well, at that rate, $12 a year, I think we're worth paying that.
Yeah, that's pretty worthwhile, so we did that. I'm now getting the right one, which I probably have tomorrow or the next day for Selden. We'll see if we can make its problems go away.
Roughly what, how far out on the LAE is Selden?
Say again?
Just conceptually, how far out on the LAE do you have to go to get to Selden? Do you know what exit that is?
Is it 63, 64, I forget. It's around where, it's a little past Stony Brook University.
Okay, gotcha. I've got a customer out at 65 out in Yaphank. I had to go out there a couple of times last week, but just curious if I had to actually pass the repeater or not.
Yeah, it's North Ocean Avenue, if you know where that is.
Is the tower visible from the LAE?
If you know where to look.
Okay, but it's not blatantly visible. There were a couple of towers that were blatantly visible.
Yeah, it's a bit off in the distance, but it's on the highest point there, so, I mean, you can't miss it.
Yeah, next time I'm out there, I'll have to keep an eye out in the low 60s, see what I can find.
Yeah, let me know if you're going out that way one day, I'll show it to you.
I understand, but usually when I'm going out there, I've got 4 or 5 hours worth of other work to do.
Yeah, let's put it this way. It takes me about 40 minutes to get there from Plainview.
Yeah, I think I clock about 105, 110 to get there from my house.
Okay, I've got to play it now, and I'm going to get out of here. Have fun. K2IOK,
K2J. Okay, have a good evening. I'll catch you later. K2YO's clear, QSYRF.
Adios, K2J.
Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1721 with a release date of Friday, August 6th, 2010, to follow in 5, in 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QSC. Ham Radio Scouting and the ISS combined at the 2010 Boy Scouts of America Jamboree will take you to the scene. Also, a major flare-up on the sun causes propagation changes here on Earth, and the FCC's new National Emergency Radio System proposal draws a negative response from those who will have to use it. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1721. It comes your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, from Los Angeles, here is Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF.
A very successful contact was made on Saturday, July 31st, between 6 scouts at the 2010 National Boy Scout Jamboree and astronaut Doug Wheelock, KF4BOC, on board the International Space Station. Amateur Radio Newsline's Mark Abramovich, NT3V, reports from Fort AP Hill in Virginia.
N1SS, N1SS, this is K2BSA, K2 Boy Scouts of America.
K2BSA, we've got you loud and clear aboard the International Space Station. This is Colonel Doug Wheelock, and on behalf of my crew, I wanted to wish you all great day down there, and we're looking forward to talking to you.
And that's how it started here on the K2BSA site on a pleasant Saturday afternoon, as youth staff member Andrew Kamey, KE5GDB, who is Amateur Radio Newsline's 2009 Young Ham of the Year, initiated the biggest contact of the Jamboree. The six scouts represented Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. All got a chance to take part in a truly out-of-this-world experience they won't soon forget. Each got to ask astronaut Wheelock a question, some relating to scouting and the space program. Fritzy, a 15-year-old life scout from Devon, Pennsylvania, asked Wheelock whether scouting could have a positive effect on space exploration. The answer, scouting has the right stuff for the astronauts.
Flying in space is much like scouting and much like a lot of things in life that difficult to accomplish with one person, but you need good team building skills and good leadership skills to be an astronaut, the same skills that are key to be a good scout.
Fritzy was impressed.
They're in space, they're in zero gravity, and you're down here on Earth just sort of going through a normal day.
Mark, a 12-year-old first-class scout from Charlotte, North Carolina, says this was a first for him.
I've talked to one astronaut on Earth before, but I've never talked to someone on space, and that's really cool, and I don't think I expected to do that.
Jonathan, a star scout from Reading, Pennsylvania, asked Wheelock whether astronauts like scouts are trained to improvise, especially when equipment fails.
That's the second most important thing that you learn in scouting that you need to have as an astronaut, and that's the skill of problem solving. To be able to look at a problem, because things are going to break. If you're working with machinery, things are going to break, and you have to use what you can, what tools you have, and what knowledge you have about that system to fix it.
Jonathan says he was happy to be chosen to play a role in the event.
I never expected the scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst, 10 being the best. I'd give it a 10.
Connor, a 13-year-old scout from Buchanan, Georgia, agreed.
It was amazing.
David, a 15-year-old life scout from Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, echoed the sentiment.
It was really cool talking to someone who was in space, and it was a very amazing experience.
For Quinn, an Eagle Scout from Carrollton, Georgia, the experience will stay with him.
Personally, I think it's amazing because I'm talking to someone who's representing the pinnacle of humanity's hopes and dreams, because he is, you know, reaching out into the unknown, and he's helped our species go out and explore and change the way we live.
And Quinn confided the contact with Wheelock helped cement in his mind the kind of profession he'd like to pursue.
When I was told not to be nervous, I said, oh, no, I'm not going to be nervous because hopefully one day I'll be on the other end of the radio. I'll be the person talking to Boy Scouts or other people back on Earth from the space station or from space in general.
Wheelock clearly enjoyed the brief exchange, and the scouts say it's a memory they'll cherish for a lifetime. From the 100th anniversary celebration of the founding of the Boy Scouts of America, here at the National Jamboree at Fort A.P. Hill in Virginia, I'm Mark Abramovich, NT3D.
Amateur Radio Newsline has obtained exclusive rights to air the entire contact between the scouts at the Jamboree and Doug Wheelock on board the ISS. It's available right now at our website, arnewsline.org. Mark will be back with us later in the newscast with a wrap-up on the ham radio event at this year's Scouting Jamboree. If you notice some strange propagation, or maybe the lack of it this past week, there's a reason. During the early hours of August 1st, a complex eruption on the Sun sent a coronal mass ejection, also called a CME, toward Earth. NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory recorded a complex global disturbance on the Sun's Earth-facing side, and most of the Sun's northern hemisphere was involved in the event. This included a long-duration Class C3 solar flare and a massive filament eruption. As a result of the blast, the coronal mass ejection was sent out into space, hurtling towards Earth as one of its targets. This means that high-latitude geomagnetic storms and auroras were possible when the cloud did arrive on our planet. More information is online at spaceweather.com, S-P-A-C-E.